I'm also very happy to say that we have just this event as the start of a much bigger week celebrating agriculture. And the Ag Council of America has put on a lot of good events for tomorrow. And Colin Woodall, would you please give us a short announcement on what you expect the next day?
Thank you, Sarah. My name's Colin Woodall. I'm the chairman of the Agriculture Council of America. We are the ones that are putting on all of the National Ag Day events. So welcome to you all for coming in and being a part of this great part of Ag Day. And a special thanks to Sarah and the entire AgriPulse team. This has become one of the great events of all of the National Ag Day celebrations. I want to make sure that you are all invited tomorrow to our mix and mingle lunch up on Capitol Hill. It's going to be in the Cannon Caucus Room. That will start at 11:30. And we also have our dinner tomorrow night at USDA. Are there still tickets left, Jenny? So there's still tickets left. We would love to have you join us if you have not purchased your tickets yet. But this is just a great opportunity to take the time to visit with members of Congress, the administration, and continue to tell the story that America's farmers and ranchers are the best stewards of the air, the land, the water, the natural resources, the overall welfare of the animals. And without all of us, people don't eat and people aren't clothed very well. And we need to make sure we continue to tell that story. So thank you all for being a great part of National Ag Day. And Sarah, again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Colin. And thanks to everybody in the Ag Council for putting together a tremendous set of events. I'd like to kick off our panel today with just a brief introduction, recognizing the fact that we've got some tremendous challenges ahead of us. You know, when we're thinking about trying to feed 9 billion people on this planet by 2050, we need to make some changes. We've been having great advances in productivity, but they need to be even faster and more broader and also more sustainable in our production methods. And so we've got a real good, comprehensive set of experts here this afternoon to give us their view on innovation in agriculture and what is going to be needed in terms of feeding the nine by 2050. And you should have a bio on each of your seats for each of our panelists, so I'm just going to introduce them very quickly, and then I'll introduce Congressman Rodney Davis when he does join us after his votes. But starting off on my left is Bill Horan, an Iowa farmer who grows pharmaceutical crops, among other things, and is also the chairman of Truth About Trade and Technology. Next to him is Paul Sauter, the president and CEO of Sauter's Eggs, a third-generation business, and he's also chairman of the American Egg Board. And I already asked, he did not bring Kevin Bacon along, so you're out of luck on that one, but I do hope you look at their ads because they're quite innovative in themselves. Next to him is David Fischoff, the chief scientist for Climate Corp. And David, we're glad to have you join us here from your background. And last but not least, Ronnie Green, the vice president for Ag and Natural Resources at the University of Nebraska. And so welcome to all of you. I've asked each of them to make some brief opening comments, and then we're going to open it up for my questions and your questions and keep the conversation going. So with that, Bill, please kick us off.
You want me to use this mic here?
What,
this one? Well, thank you, Sarah. My name is Bill Horan. I'm a corn farmer from northwest Iowa. I live in the flat part of the state, the northern part that the glacier shaved off. It's really flat. Our dog ran away one time, and we could see him for 3 days. So I oftentimes find myself on panels like this with people with many advanced degrees, and I don't have an advanced degree. But I was always proud to say when I graduated from college, I graduated in the half of the class that made their top half possible. So a few years ago, my brother and I were looking around at ways to diversify our farm. And we happened upon a company in France, Meristem Therapeutics, that were interested in multiplying protein-based human pharmaceuticals in crops. Of course, you probably know that about a third of the common drugs that are used today are multiplied in bioreactors by bacteria, genetically altered bacteria. The bacteria are harvested, the protein drug is extracted and purified, and you have your raw drug. Well, years ago, many folks from Monsanto figured out how to insert genes into plants and do the same thing. So we started out with them with a canine lipase for cystic fibrosis patients. Canine lipase is a lipase that's found in the pancreas of dogs, and it's harvested and it's given to people with cystic fibrosis so that they can digest fat molecules. Most people know that people with cystic fibrosis have mucus on their lungs, and your little children, the parents have to beat them on the back to loosen up the lung material. The other thing that happens with cystic fibrosis is they can't digest fat molecules. Well, the lipase enables them to do that. And what happens is if they can digest fat molecules, they can keep their strength up and their health up, and they can fight the lung issues much better. So that was the first project that we started off on. The second project we did was for a company called Venturia Biosciences from Sacramento, California. They're now located in eastern Kansas. And we produced for them, we multiplied for them, lactoferrin and lysozyme. Lactoferrin and lysozyme are two drugs that are found in breast milk. And they give the baby immunity. They're very heavy in the colostrum. So the idea was to multiply this in dry land rice and give it to patients that are on chemotherapy, because patients on chemotherapy are worried about infection, pneumonia, getting sick. So this is a natural drug found in breast milk that can be used to boost up their immune system so that they can take the chemotherapy better and not get infections. We have gone through a number of different companies and helped them through their beginning stages. Right now, we're working with a company in Germany who has, we're producing for them human RNA in potatoes. And so we have, in our plots, we have all our little potato people out there growing. And this is a company that's really on the cutting edge now of producing drugs that are naturally produced in the human body and can be multiplied in potatoes. We ship the potatoes back to Germany where the drug is extracted and used in topicals. So that's a real brief summary of what we're doing in our pharmaceutical business. I did want to also mention, though, that just in case you don't know, the Midwest farmers are rapidly adapting site-specific agriculture. We've been doing it for probably 15 years or more on our farm. All of the crop protection products and all of fertility is site-specifically applied. We farm 4,000 acres, and all of our land is divided into 4.4-acre grids. So basically, we have 1,000 4-acre farms. Each 4 acres is treated separately. And as the fertility or crop protection application equipment goes across the farm, every time it goes into a new 4-acre plot, it changes the recipe if necessary for that plot. So we only put on fertilizer where it's needed and as much as is needed. And it's just, of course, the way that that everybody's being as efficient as possible in this global agriculture. So there's a lot going on in agriculture right now. I'm going to make one last comment. The Monsanto folks have complained to us when they come to Iowa State University, and I'm sure it's the same in Nebraska, that when they come to the College of Agriculture, they have to go down to the junior class to find students that don't have a job. And they said most of the seniors in the College of Agriculture have at least 3 job offers. So when you hear on the news about all these kids getting the degree and moving back in the basement of their parents, that's not true in agriculture. That's not true at all. We're in really good times in agriculture. Our commodity prices are low right now, but that'll come back. So we're really on a roll, and appreciate being here.
Thank you, Bill. Very good. And we're going to hear more about his operation a little later in the Q&A. But Paul?
Well, good afternoon. It's good to be here and to share a little bit about the Sauter Egg Company. But I just want to make one comment about the fact that most of us go once or twice a year to see our accountant, especially about this time of year as you're getting ready to pay your taxes. But just think about how many times you need a farmer. When you figure you eat 3 meals a day, it's about 1,095 times a year you need that farmer to produce food for him. So I just want to throw that out there. I am the third generation. My son is the fourth generation in our family business. We got our start in Brownstown, Pennsylvania. We're now in three different states. We're into Maryland, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. We have about 6.5 million chickens that produce eggs for us. We're also now looking at the consumer and what they're looking for, and so we're into the organic, we're into the cage-free eggs, we're into commodity eggs. And one of the things that, you know, I can really be proud of today is the fact that we made the full circle in eggs. Back in the 70s, when I got involved in the egg business, I didn't tell people when I was on the plane I was in the egg business. I just said I was in the food business because of the cholesterol issue. And everyone says we were producing like prison pill that was going to kill y'all, to where today the national guidelines that just came out says that they're going to remove the dietary cholesterol guidelines. And so the handcuffs are off with us eggs, and we're finally back into good graces. And, you know, back in the 40s and 50s, there was about 400 eggs per person per year consumption on eggs. We dropped to the low of 230 back in the early 80s. And today, I can tell you last year, we're back up to 260. So the consumer is now also looking at the protein, and they want that protein in the morning. They don't want the carbs. They don't want the sugar, which that is where eggs really fit into that real nicely. As far as the innovation that we have done in our company, it was all the cholesterol was the number one issue. And then the second issue why people weren't eating eggs was they kept saying they weren't convenient. So I kept looking at that and saying there's got to be a way to make eggs convenient. So we got into hard cooking of eggs, and we were the first company to put hard-cooked eggs into a stand-up pouch and put them in supermarkets. And so if you go to some supermarkets like Wise Markets and Safeway, they have pouches of hard-cooked eggs, which makes it convenient when you want to make your salad at night for dinner, because you're not going to take that time to hard-cook and peel an egg to put on your salad or to whatever you want to make. You'll just skip the egg. Well, this has really been a real boost for us for the demand for eggs. We're now also looking at doing flavored eggs. We do a buffalo hot egg, which is similar to if you want to eat buffalo wings. It tastes the same, except the texture is a little bit different. We make red beet eggs. We're making mustard eggs. We're into making deviled egg kits for retail for deli departments. Because every time you go to a party, the number one thing that goes is the deviled eggs, even before the shrimp, if you stop and think about it. So we figured that out and figured we're going to start making them. My next move is to make a retail kit for a deviled egg kit so that you could pick them up at the retail store and take them home and make 10 or 12 of them to for your picnic or for your dinner for Easter Sunday coming up. There's a couple other different ideas that I'm working on. I won't mention them now because it's kind of a trade secret of some of the things we're working on. But I do also want to mention the fact that when I got into the business, our chickens were producing about 240 eggs per year, and they were laying for about 1 year. Today, we're laying chickens for 70 weeks, and we're getting 430 eggs out of that chicken. So you can see we've had tremendous increases in production, and it's due to the genetics, it's due to the feeding formulation we're giving, and the housing that we're giving those chickens, and taking better care of our chickens, giving them more space, which then in turn, they're rewarding us with more eggs. So all those things work together so that we are being good stewards. And as far as food safety, one of the things that I was initially involved in was our PCAP program that we started in Pennsylvania, which was Egg Quality Assurance Program, because we knew that there was salmonella issues with eggs, but we had no idea where it was coming from. So we started this program with a conjunction of FDA, USDA, Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture, and figured out that there is salmonella in fresh shell eggs, and we had to figure out a way to keep it out, and we did that. And we were 20 years ahead of the FDA federal program that they initiated 2 years ago. So it is a good program. It's a great program. And I always say is that you're one egg away from going out of business if you serve an egg that has salmonella in it. And that's one of the things as an egg industry we can't have. Food safety has to be foremost and most with what we do with our business. And with that, I'll close.
Thank you, Paul. David?
Well, I'm really happy to be here to be able to talk about what we're doing at the Climate Corporation. And I think to set the context, you know, what we heard right at the outset from Sarah really informs a lot of what we do, which is, you know, there is a lot of pressure on agriculture today to increase production, increase yields, and at the same time do it more sustainably. I think we all in this room know better than most where a lot of that pressure is coming from increased population, increased demand for protein compared to vegetable-based diets, as well as the increased per capita income around the world, not just in developed countries. So great demand for food. At the same time, really not much opportunity to expand the footprint of agriculture and a lot of desire to even shrink that land footprint for lots and lots of reasons. At the same time, you know, it's a sort of a litany of issues, but you know, we do have to deal with climate change, which is going to put pressure on overall productivity, probably worldwide, and we need to make agriculture ready to deal with that. So the question then becomes, well, how do we go about that? And you know, I've had the opportunity and really been the great fortune to have lived through at least a couple of waves of innovation in agriculture that have really helped drive productivity and improve sustainability. I wasn't around for the hybridization of corn, but I did participate in the biotech revolution, working especially on insect-resistant crops. I worked a lot on genomics of crops that has led to real revolutionary advances in plant breeding to really push yields and productivity in many, many crops. And now, having joined the Climate Corporation, I'm involved in what I would say is going to be an equivalent sort of technological revolution in terms of productivity that's really driven by data science, what some people call big data. And I think we're really at the very, very beginning of this new technology. So when we think about it from the perspective of climate, but I think it's true for many, many people who are working in this field, what's happening is really a result of a couple of trends. One is the digitization of literally everything, not just agriculture, but agriculture certainly participates. You know, the number of sensors, especially wireless sensors that are available in the world is, you know, in the billions and the tens of billions. You know, cell phones like this one, you know, are just chock full of sensors themselves. Wireless connectivity, the cost of all of this, digitization going down dramatically, whether it's for data generation or data storage, is creating huge opportunities. Coupled with that, and this didn't start with agriculture, but we're certainly the great beneficiaries in being able to participate in it, is that the computing tools are becoming available to allow us to deal with all this digital data. It's one thing to have a digital representation of something in the world, you know, a yield map instead of just a photograph of a field, for example. But if you can't deal with that digital data in some way, that yield map, and make use of it, do some analysis of it, It just sits there, you know, perhaps as a nice pretty picture on your wall or in your desk drawer. But the computing revolution and the advent of what we now refer to, which, you know, wasn't even a term when I was in school, and I don't even know that I heard it until well into my scientific career, of what we call data science. That is the statistical tools that have been developed, the computing tools developed to deal with this data, now allow us to really make some headway there, because we can now analyze this data. So data alone has some value, but not necessarily great value. As you kind of go up this stack, you know, you get analyzed data, which, you know, gives you more value. From that, you can get insights, and insights are even more valuable, and ultimately up to recommendations. And our view of the world from the Climate Corporation is that we're creating products that will allow us to take data in agriculture and kind of move up that stack so that we can make very specific recommendations to growers about their practices to increase productivity, increase yield, and do that more sustainably. We think about our program really in sort of three pieces that are all linked together. One is measurements. That's where the data comes from. And this doesn't have to be generated by us by any means. It can be all sorts of data. It can be data that's in the public domain. It can be weather data that's available, at least in the U.S., from our government-supported National Weather Service, part of NOAA. It can be farmer-generated data. That is data that's generated as farm equipment moves across the moves across the field. We also generate some data ourselves. We have an agronomy team that can carry out really sort of purposely designed experiments to generate data, because not all the data that's available is necessarily going to fit into what we need. And then we take that data, and from that, we create models. And this is where data science comes in. And the bulk of our research effort is really devoted to the modeling effort. And these tend to be models that give predictions. That's at least our goal and our desire. Now, as you start out, maybe those predictions are not going to be so great, but as you collect more data, the models get smarter and smarter, and the predictions get better and better. And of course, being a company, we get not just the ability to ground truth that those predictions by going out into the real world, but we get real customer feedback as well, which is probably the best sort of ground truthing as to whether the predictions we're making are useful and valuable and accurate. And then the next and the final step for us is what we would call execution. And how do we tie all this together so that we can deliver it to customers? And really, for us at least, that comes in two forms. One is software tools, user interfaces, apps that can be mobile or on desktop or laptop computers. For example, suites of tools like we've had the last couple of years called Climate Basic, which gives sort of basic information about weather and other aspects of your field, but also some higher value tools like our Nitrogen Advisor that makes predictions and recommendations for amount of nitrogen side dress application based on weather and other events. And those can be delivered seamlessly, like I said, through apps that can be on your phone, on your pad. They can be in your cab as well, and as well as having equipment that can carry out these operations. Monsanto, prior to the acquisition of Climate, had acquired a high-tech planting company called Precision Planting that makes the hardware that can actually carry out a lot of these operations. And I think we're going to see, as time goes on, this further melding of software tools and hardware tools so that recommendations can be seamlessly executed. Our goal is to have a platform that allows both for the collection of data as well as the distribution of data and recommendations in this kind of seamless and integrated form. With that, I think I'll stop there.
Thank you. Go ahead. Ronnie, you're going to have to train this whole next generation of innovators. So tell us what's going on with the University of Nebraska in that regard.
Well, first of all, it's a pleasure to be here today and to be part of National Ag Week and recognizing the importance and the value that farmers and ranchers bring to our country here in the U.S. and the stewardship that they have for the natural resources that they manage for all of us. So a shout out to all of America's farmers and ranchers this week. You've already heard from a number of the panelists talk about feeding the 9, the 2 billion more people in the world, the increasing middle class around the world, 20% projected increase in the middle class, the need for more animal protein has been referenced, and the growing demand worldwide that we expect to see. So we talk all the time with our students and with our faculty about we're living in 2015, but we're thinking in 2050 and thinking about what those needs are going to be that help us to think about what needs to drive that innovation. And one of the statistics that we worry a lot about and we think a lot about is water. And it's probably not a surprise to you, knowing where I hail from, that water is an issue where, you know, 70% of the world's water today is employed in agriculture, used in agriculture and the growing of food around the world. The estimates are that that number will be closer to 90% a few decades away from now. So this innovation that we're talking about, and we've heard some really good examples of, spreads to that natural resource base on the sustainability side as well. I'm going to mention and refer to a comment that was made earlier about the pipeline of human talent and the need that is there and the demand that's there for training in agriculture and natural resources. We are indicative of what a number of universities are seeing around the country. Iowa State was mentioned earlier, where over the last 10 years, we've seen continual increase in enrollment for students studying in various fields of the agricultural sciences and natural resources, and the social science areas attached to those as well. We've doubled our enrollment in those fields in the last 8 years. We've had four consecutive years of record enrollment in those fields at our university in for 149-year history. That demand is being driven by the demand for this talent and the demand to go into that innovation space, the fact that there are three jobs for every graduate that's there that was mentioned earlier, those high-talented students are making their way into the workforce very readily. We decided a number of years ago now, 3 years ago, that we needed to address that need. So we've actually now increased our faculty in this area, in ag, for the first time in a number of decades, by 20% in the last 2 years. And we're deploying those faculty in areas around this issue of water and food, and around understanding how everything we do in the future will be geared toward producing those high-quality products, but with less water and under a climate-resilient kind of agriculture. So we've heard a little bit about that on the big data side already. So the investments that we're making are not traditional ones. You know, we're making investments in the big data arena. We're making investments in the phenomics arena on the plant side to be able to produce climate-smart agriculture. But we're also making investments in rethinking some of the biology that is there. So things like on the food side, you know, we were talking about food safety earlier, partnering with public-private partnerships, not working alone in the university system, but instead working with private partners to do things like think about new sanitation methodology in food manufacturing. We're standing up a new advanced sanitation for food as part of our Nebraska Innovation Campus with 8 food companies involved in the public good in thinking about how do we create new surfaces? You know, how do we move from a stainless steel environment that we've had for many years to something that's nano-driven and nanoparticle, you know, nanoscience kind of driven technology. And then on the human side, we are the consumers of that good food and nutritious and safe food that American agriculture produces and people around the world. We also are now beginning to think about human health related to that food in food science. So now doing things thinking about the genomics revolution in terms of microbiology of the human microbiome. That's a hot area, huge area that we expect now to see a lot of development happen in, where we cater that microbiome to the food availability that's there. I'm going to close by just making one statement that may spark some controversy in our panel. Innovation requires an open road to succeed. So having the opportunity to develop technology, best use of technology, to be able to continue to work toward meeting these goals that are out there long term, requires the opportunity for those technologies to be successful. So, you know, we have some challenges there related to application of the technologies that we're going to be able to develop. And I hope we have an open road there to be able to innovate for American agriculture and for the food system globally in the future. And I'll close, Sarah.
Well, thank you. But let's dig into that a little bit more. And where are the roadblocks that those of you who are innovating are facing? Are they on the regulatory side? Are they on the economic side in terms of having the investment capital to develop new products? Or, I mean, you don't just go out there and plant without a permit, I assume. So how long does it take you to overcome some of these roadblocks? Is that your whole list?
Yeah, that's
the answer to your question is yes. Well, I just brought these along. This is a USDA, APHIS at USDA is who regulates the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, regulates unapproved proteins. And so this is an example of a permit I don't know how many pages that is, but if I'm in violation of, each page I'm in violation with is $10,000 a day fine. So we have to pay attention to this permit. And this is how we do it. This is our SOP, Standard Operating Procedures for Growing Unapproved Biologics. And what I mean by an unapproved biologic, it's like Roundup Ready soybeans. Before they were approved for commercial sale, they were classified as an unapproved biologic. And so the drugs that we produce are unapproved biologics. But it's taken us a number of years with the help of the APHIS folks. I think when we got started a few years ago, I came out to Beltsville and we sat down and we talked about how can you produce pharmaceuticals in a way that makes sense. And I was helping folks that work in a cubicle understand modern agriculture. So, and I found them to be very receptive, and they've been very good to work with, exceptionally good to work with. As a farmer, I work with a lot of agencies, and APHIS is one of the ones that's really, really good to work with. But you've got to do it right, and you can't make any mistakes.
Paul, your thoughts on any roadblocks that you're facing in the regulatory arena?
We don't have as much trouble regulatory as we do is getting them into the retail channel is our biggest obstacle because it takes a lot of money to develop the product. And then when you take it to the retail market, they want shelf space money to put the product on the shelf. And then, you know, you also have to have money to promote it. And so it's a constant writing out checks until you can get any kind of traction for your product. So that's one of the biggest roadblocks we have.
How long does it take you, for example, your buffalo hard-boiled eggs, how long does it take if you start today to develop a new product like that?
That product was about 3 years till we got it to where it was. You know, I had an idea of taking a hard-cooked egg and putting a little bit of the Tabasco bottles in with my hard-cooked egg and selling them that way, but I couldn't figure out a way to get it through production that would make it economically feasible for a consumer to buy. So now we put them in a jar with 11 eggs, and it's in a solution that is shelf-stable for a year without refrigeration, and it tastes just like a buffalo wings without the meat and the bones.
Should have brought them for the reception. We could have all shared. Dave, how about you in terms of innovation? How long in the cycle does it take once you start with a new data product or a new...
That's a good question, and it's been a real eye-opener for me working now in this digital agriculture and in the software world. Where compared to a biotech product that might be 10 years from discovery through development, regulatory approval, and introduction into a whole variety of new hybrids, the products that we develop, it depends on at which scale we're looking, but a new feature, for example, if we get some grower feedback about a user interface and we need to just tweak it a little, that can literally be 2 or 3 weeks before we turn it around. It's just like getting an update for an app on your smartphone. For a new product that's based on research that we've already done, so for example, if we've done enough weather modeling and we want to translate something that we've done for corn in one region to corn in another part of the country or to soybeans, that might be a year or so, maybe 2 years. For a brand new product where we have to actually go out and collect data, say the data doesn't exist or it's not abundant enough, then we're talking maybe 2+ years. But compared to the other areas of science that I've been in with, you know, the 10 and 10 plus year timelines for new products, this seems lightning fast.
So, Ronnie, what are you hearing from innovators that come to you and say, how can you help us speed these things up?
Well, one of the things I guess I was referring to with my last comment was, in a more general sense, concern about, you know, the policies, regulation around new product development being science-based. You know, that we put the firm science basis underneath those technologies, evaluation of those technologies, efficacies of those technologies for use in producing food products. And I have to say, as a scientist, you know, I'm a geneticist and an animal scientist by training. As a scientist, I I'm concerned about the current, you know, discussion about whether things are science-based or not, and whether it's accepted that they're science-based or their credibility is undermined by, you know, questioning the science in a way that's not appropriate. So that's more of my big concern about technology in the future.
Well, it seems like we've got a growing number of people who believe a lot of food bloggers. And, you know, the Food Babe was just in the New York Times over the weekend as another blogger took on kind of her perception of science. And so how do you communicate the things that you're trying to do that are, from your perspective, science-based to a group of consumers who may not be willing to do the deep dive and understand all the different types of scientific analysis that goes into these decisions?
You're asking me? Well, it's a complex issue. It's a complex challenge because, as you mentioned, Sarah, there's a minority of people directly involved in food production, a majority who are not or are removed from food production. So an understanding of that system is, of course, part of the importance, understanding the science in the system. And, you know, I equate it to maybe a disconnect from nature and nurture a bit. You know, the further removed we are from nature and nurture as a culture, the harder it is to understand nature and nurture in our culture and the food systems. That's a more sort of a generic example, but there's a where I think a root part of the problem may be.
Paul?
From a standpoint of egg production, there's a real disconnect between the consumers when it comes to science and reality and perception. And the fact that science, we can prove that chickens are better off in a confinement area versus one that are cage-free. We get better production, better livability, more eggs, better feed conversion, sustainability. Everything is better, but yet our cage-free production demand is just going through the roof. The consumer just wants that cage-free chicken because they just think they're better off. So there's a real disconnect between science and perception.
Thoughts on that?
Well, I think there's several avenues to approach on this problem. You know, one is there used to be, three scientific journals for decades and decades in this country that people relied on for good information. Now there's, a dozen. And some of the journals, if you're a researcher, you can actually pay the journal to print your research, whether it's reputable or not. And so it's confusing to consumers out there. They don't know where is the place to go. And I'm going to put a plug in for truthabouttradeandtechnology.org. Every week we write an op-ed, and or oftener if we need to tamp down some of the things that come out of the activist sphere. Because we found that if you react with good science to some of the things that are said immediately, it helps it from catching fire and taking off. The activist community is excellent at taking their thoughts and digesting them down to a bumper sticker that sounds reasonable until you start looking at the science, and it's not reasonable at all. So there's a number of ways we need to combat the bad science that's out there. And, you know, it's the old story, follow the money. There's a lot of people make a lot of money scaring people about food.
So I'm going to ask another question, but we also have a couple people roving with microphones. Jason's got one here, and Sarah Gonzalez will come over to this side of the room. So if any of you have questions, please raise your hand, and they'll bring a microphone to you so that you can have a chance to ask the first person here with these experts of what they're seeing and as they try to innovate in agriculture. I wanted to, not to put you on the spot, Ronnie, here, but you are a representative of Land-Grant University, and I'd like to have the other panelists talk about how they work with public institutions, if they do at all, for expert advice, and if they don't, why not? Paul, would you start with that?
Yeah, we work with Penn State with their food science, and we're working with them right now on coming up with a better way to sanitize our eggs, our hard-cooked eggs, to get the plate counts down so we can get longer shelf life. And we're in a challenge study right now to make that happen. So, yeah, we work with them all the time.
Okay. Bill?
We have consultants that help us with our crop management, and they get their information from the Extension Service. But as long as we're on the topic, I have a gripe against the Extension Service. You know, it was it's a great institution, a great service, and it was designed, I don't know, 70 years ago, maybe 100 years ago, when farmers came into town on Saturday night and sold their eggs and their cream and then went down to the extension office and got their answers for their questions for that week. It was a great system. Well, today, farmers don't operate that way. I mean, it's a digital world. And I never go to the extension office. And my complaint is that there's 100 counties in Iowa, and each county has an extension office, which is, I don't know, $100,000 budget, maybe more. And through the magic of multiplication, it starts to look like $10 million. And I'm thinking as a farmer and as a consumer, maybe that $10 million could be better spent if it was kept on campus for research and other projects. The delivery system is digital to me of the information. I just want more research. And I think the money, in my opinion, could be better spent kept on campus.
David, any thoughts on that? And then Ronnie will let you react to these.
Yeah. Well, I won't comment specifically on that, I don't think, but we work very closely with land-grant universities and the whole public sector ag research community. In our end of the business, creating some of these new models and these new digital projects, products, almost always the first step is to read a bunch of papers, and almost always the papers that we're reading are ones that are coming out of land grant universities. They're often small studies, but they point you in the right direction, and often that's the initial data that we have access to. You know, someone has done a study, for example, on, you know, amount of nitrogen necessary to grow corn in a particular type of soil. Usually the fruits of, you know, one poor graduate student who's been out there for three or four summers in the field, but that's what it takes to get any of this started. And then as our products mature, we love to get them into the hands of both extension as well as faculty members on campus to actually give us real user feedback. Tell us, you know, if you were to use this tool, Would you recommend it? Would you believe the recommendations and the advice that it's giving you? Tell us what we can do to make it better. And I do have to put a plug in too for really just more research. I had the opportunity a few years ago to serve on the working group that created that PCAS study on agricultural competitiveness. And you know, one of the big messages, maybe the big message out of that, was that we needed to increase ag research in the U.S. by something like $700 million a year, and that's still true. It's not just for the fruits of the research in terms of the publications and the data, but for the training of the students. And it's even though I'm working now at sort of the high tech end where of agriculture, where we certainly need to attract and hire software engineers and data scientists, I can tell you, at every level of agriculture, it's as much the traditional agricultural sciences, plant pathologists, entomologists, agronomists, soil science is in desperate need, but is a hugely valuable science for us to for all the tools that we want to develop. So, I think public research is critical and even more critical now.
I'm glad you brought up the PCAS report because, you know, there is an underfunding of ag research and investment in ag research across the board, whether it's land-grant universities or in the private sector. So if you look at the numbers, I think it's 1.9% of GDP is, you know, relative to a 3% target that there should be in investment in the ag and food space, and we're at 1.9. So the PCAS report did a great job of pointing that out, and it also did a great job of saying that it's not only USDA that should be investing in ag research. It also should be the National Science Foundation. It should be the National Institutes of Health. It should be the Department of Energy. And there's some of that happens already, but more of that needs to happen. I mentioned in my comments about public-private partnership, sir, in response to your question, that that has multiple forms. So public-private partnership isn't only a land-grant university working with a company in the agribusiness sector or a service provider in the agribusiness sector. That's one form of public-private partnership. The other form of public-private partnership is with networks of producers. And I think we are going to see that become increasingly important, maybe back to the way it was earlier in times when we had a more networked producer cooperation with land-grant universities. I'll give you an example of that. We have a water management demonstration network in Nebraska that has 1,100 producers in it spread throughout the state who are trying to deploy technology to reduce water use across irrigated production. That's actually being run by Extension, you know, in this particular case, by an Extension research faculty member that's allowing us to reduce water use by use of relatively simple technology in terms of sensor technology to be able to apply water when it's really needed on a more precise way. The trainer model in Extension, you're right, you know, relative to what my father used Extension for as a producer or my uncle's. It's now more of a train-the-trainer model than what it was in the past. But don't forget that much of the Extension effort now is directed toward the consumer as much or more than toward the producer. And I know that's part of maybe what we were talking a little bit about earlier, about ag literacy, ag and food literacy, and understanding that in the urban areas of our states, you know, as opposed to the rural areas as well.
Yeah, good point. Jason, is there a question over here? Okay, then we have one here. I thought I saw a hand over there. I'm sorry.
Okay, Mom. Chuck Zimmerman with AgWire. Thank you very much. I'd like to, I heard the word activist up there, so there's a current story tied to this that I thought I'd just bring up. What are the innovations that we're doing? What are the innovations you think we should be doing in terms of dealing with the emotional activism, of which the latest big disgusting example is the organic-only new McDonald video. I don't know how many people have seen it, but it's absolutely ludicrous. But that kind of stuff touches on a real emotional level. And like somebody said, you know, the put the message on the bumper sticker type thing. But what are the innovations we need to do in agriculture and agribusiness to deal with that, because facts don't matter to these people?
So the question deals with what innovations do we need to combat some of the activist messages that have gone viral. Thoughts on anything that you've done? I referenced earlier, Paul, that you've got a great campaign out that has just been launched. Maybe you want to talk even about that.
Well, in reference to your question, I think the biggest thing in production agriculture, we've hid behind the barn door, and for generations we were not doing what we should have done. We let economics get in the way of the animal welfare issues, and we have since changed that, at least in egg production, to where now we're proud of what we're doing. We're proud of the space that we're giving our chickens, and but it is a really tough message to get out there, because the fact is that they still think those chickens should be able to be free running, whether it's in your backyard or down the street. I'm not quite sure where it's at, but, you know, California voted for cage-free chickens, basically, for the whole state, even though they were only buying about 3% until they were forced to come January the 15th. It is really a difficult issue when you get the different activist groups that are out there preaching their message to get it across. But it's something that we need to be more proactive and promote our practices and open up the door and let reporters come, let people come and see what you're doing. That's the best way that I know how to get our message out.
Any other thoughts on what you're doing with Truth About
Trade? Yeah, Truth About Trade and Technology, you know, we put those op-eds out every week, but we're focusing now on social media and especially mommy bloggers. You know, we focus on getting good information to the people that purchase the food for the family. And I think we've had some real success there. At least we're getting good feedback.
Yeah, I think social media is a really important tool, one that wasn't always available and certainly not always taken up by people in agriculture, maybe people of my generation. I think Sarah mentioned that she sees Rob Fraley's postings on Twitter and other social media, and he's just one example, but I think a great example of what more people have to do, because that's largely the way that communications are being carried out these days.
Mm-hmm. And Casey, you get to teach him about Twitter after this. Ronnie?
I would say ditto to all of that, especially the social media piece, that where some of the perception that's out there is being driven by social media. Social media is being used to drive those perceptions and those false perceptions. I would also add, though, that agriculture generally and food production generally needs to take back the mantle of being green. We need to take back the mantle of being environmental stewards and being sustainable. And why ag and food is more sustainable today than it's ever been in our history. And we need to take that environmental green mantle back, because it's been taken away, is the way I would state it.
Good point. Question over here now. Oh, here.
Yeah, if I could observe that of the 9 billion mouths that agriculture has to feed, there are always going to be quite a few that are going to be willing to criticize farmers with their proverbial mouths full. And that's what you had addressed. I'd wondered if I could take your capacity as innovators and extend it in a different direction and ask you, what's the product, what's the thing that you're going to develop that is going to be able to sway the public's mind about taking on the green mantle for agriculture, or the innovative, you know, potato chips that help you lose weight would be an example, I think, of a very popular product. When's that going to come out? What's that product that you see that's going to accomplish what we'd like to do with education?
Who's got the recipe for that one?
I don't know if I have the recipe, but I think I have a thought about the, you know, everybody talking about the 9 billion people by 2050. I serve on this advisory committee to the Federal Reserve Bank in Kansas City, and the Federal Reserve Bank in Kansas City does all the ag statistics for the other 12 banks. And I'll tell you what the economists there are worried about, not the 9 billion people by 2050. They said, you know, 3 billion more people, 3 billion more China, or 3 more Chinas. What they're worried about is there's going to be 2 or more billion more middle-class incomes. And they want meat, milk, and eggs. And it takes a lot of grain to make meat, milk, and eggs. So it's going to be enough of a problem to create enough food for 3 more Chinas. But there's 2 more Chinas worth of middle-class incomes coming. And they know that if their children get one egg or one portion of meat, or a glass of milk a day, they can increase test scores 20%. Cognitive skill development. If they get 2 of those, meat, milk, and eggs a day, they can increase test scores 40%. And those middle-class income people have the money to buy the meat, milk, and eggs. And so it's going to be a real problem, because most of the world doesn't have the money. So they think it's a real conflict coming.
I got an answer to that one. If we just take back the corn that we're using to make ethanol. And let us produce food for the world. You know, I look at it, and we're exporting a lot of eggs today, whether it's into Africa, whether it's Dubai, whether it's Hong Kong, Mexico. And I'm a firm believer that if we have reasonable input costs, we can be the food basket for the world here in the United States.
Well, we haven't got into the innovation behind biofuels, but since you opened the door on that, there has been a lot of interest in moving towards cellulosic and to actually going beyond corn-based to other forms of ethanol, and we've not seen the advancements that some folks had thought would be here much earlier. Are we going to see them in our lifetime here that you know, we will actually be converting a lot of other forms of cellulose? I know there's a new plant even in not too far away from you in Iowa State that has gone commercial, and so we're starting to see some headway. But what's your thoughts on that? No
She's
one.
She's looking at the Iowan.
Well, you know, I just
there's a lot of DGGs.
I have to remind you that there is a very, very successful advanced biofuel, you know, biodiesel, which, made from animal fat and vegetable oil. So it's kind of the stepchild that lives in the basement, but it's a very, very good fuel. Yeah, you're right, Sarah. There's two plants in Iowa that are making quite a bit of cellulosic ethanol. The cost structure isn't where they want it yet. It's not as competitive. And as we all know, that for the first time in about 5 years, ethanol is now higher priced per gallon than gasoline. It's been keeping the price of gasoline down for consumers. Now it's slightly increasing it. So, you know, we're in that phase right now. But the ethanol industry, I think, is a great example of over about a 15-year period with some subsidies, which are gone now. A lot of people don't realize corn ethanol is not subsidized anymore. But it took about a decade or more to get the technology where it is today, make it efficient, and make it competitive with petroleum that's had subsidies for 103 years. So I think it's a great example of how we can, with government programs, bring a new industry online, bring it up to the efficiencies it needs to compete, and let it go.
Got another question here.
Quint Pottinger, a soybean farmer from Kentucky. I know it takes a long time, at least when we talk about feeding the world in 2050. The technology, it may exist, but it's just not available for farmers to use as far as either genetics or when it comes in the form of mechanics or whatever it is. But as that stuff, as it does get approved and as we do, as it goes through the regulation process, are we losing our competitive edge in the U.S.? And I'm so happy that we brought up biofuels because we have programs in this country that allow other countries to take advantage of our biofuel subsidies. So I'm wondering, we're innovative and farmers and our industry is innovative, but are we letting other countries take advantage of our own innovations and are we losing our competitive edge because of that?
So the question deals with, are we losing our competitive edge to other international partners? Thoughts on that?
You know, I really don't think so. I mean, I think the U.S. has a great track record of being innovative, and then those innovations in terms of products or technologies being disseminated around the world, being taken up by others. But you know, it seems that in the U.S. we always have another wave of innovation, and you don't really see hotbeds of innovation that we have in the U.S., whether they come out of agriculture, out of traditional disciplines, or like in the area that I'm working in now in Silicon Valley with digital agriculture and digital technologies. This cycle that we have of federal funding of research that then gets spun off into private companies supported by venture capitalists, eventually usually either growing into big businesses like Google or being taken up by big companies like a Monsanto and being pushed even further, I think is unique in the world. So I don't worry too much that just because others may adopt our technologies eventually that the U.S. is losing its edge.
The only thing I would add to that, I agree with that, but the only thing I would add is go back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of investment in innovation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in the fact of the matter is Brazil and China are now outspending us on ag investment, on ag R&D. And that's a fact we can't, you know, we can't excuse or we can't not put on the table as well.
I would comment on that. I think what the questioner was getting at was the fact that there's now a pathway where Brazilian biodiesel can come into this country and get the dollar blender's credit from U.S. taxpayers. And the solution to that, of course, is to convert the blender's credit to a producer credit. So it has to be produced in this country to get that credit. But Congress doesn't seem to be willing to take that on and get it done to the detriment of the American taxpayer. And it does make us less competitive.
Yeah, I also wondered if you were addressing a little bit the fact that sometimes we get product approvals delayed in this country, especially for new biotech products, and they can be approved in Brazil or Argentina before they're approved in the U.S., yeah, taking away some of that competitive advantage after we've made the investments in research. And I know that USDA has pledged to speed that up, and we've seen some improvements in that area, but that's certainly been an issue as well. I was curious about what is the next big thing for each of you in your respective industries. As we've talked about the innovations that you've already had in the past, what's going to be the next big thing that you see in, say, next 5 years in terms of new products or new types of software and systems that if we were having this event 5 years from now, you could be celebrating that that could possibly be advanced? Thoughts?
Well, I'll go first. The thing that many people in production agriculture are wrestling with now is some sort of a transition program. And it's not because there aren't young people out there wanting to be producers of food. It's because that the capital cost is just... you just can't overcome the capital cost barriers. It's the same thing that happened to when I was growing up. We had all the ma-and-pa shoe stores, hardware stores, lumber stores, plumbing shops, and now they're, you know, Hardware Hank, Menards, Home Depot. And what happened was, you know, ma-and-pa had the lumber yard, and they had a couple hundred thousand dollars worth of inventory there, but the next generation can't come in and buy that inventory and make a profit. If the inventory is paid for, it's okay. And that's the way farming is today. Farming is about the last bastion of the ma and pa business. But it's over the next 10 years, I think a lot of it's going to disappear. And I don't know what the new structure is going to be, the new Menards, McDonald's structure of food production is going to be.
Paul?
From an egg production standpoint, the biggest issue we have is we try to get federal legislation to have equal practices across all 50 states on how eggs are going to be produced, but unfortunately we didn't get that accomplished. So now it looks like we're going to have a patchwork of each state coming out with their own legislation on how the eggs are going to be produced in that state plus what's going to be sold in that state. So it's going to be really difficult to have intercommerce going back and forth between the different states. I market in about 25 different states, and for me to match up my production to each different state's standard, it's going to be chaos. And that's exactly what Europe's going through right now, and they're having chaos over there. So I was hoping that we wouldn't have that here, but it looks like that's where we're headed for, and I really don't know the answer for it, but it's the biggest issue that we have.
And you've raised the cost dramatically, not you personally, but with the California proposition, it's raised the cost dramatically for all sorts of people that had relied on eggs as a great source of economic protein and is no longer as affordable as it once was. So we know there's been a lot of negative outcomes from that. But back to the innovation question.
Yeah, I think since we're really at the early stages of this digitization of agriculture and this digital agriculture revolution, that really what I think the next big thing is for us is going to be really the broad scale adoption of the tools and technologies, so that really on a large scale we see, you know, the vast majority of growers, at least in the major crops in the U.S., using these tools and finding that the tools are actually increasing productivity and improving sustainability. I think that's certainly on the horizon in something like the 5 to 10 year time frame.
Perfect, Ronnie.
I have one quick one. I think it's going to be gene editing and the opportunities that new area of technology that we're now beginning to understand will allow us to make accelerated change in plants and potentially animals without transfer of genetic material.
Well, thank you. And welcome, Congressman Rodney Davis from the great state of Illinois, and thank you for joining us here. I was just checking to see if we were going to wrap up or if you were able to get through all your votes, and I know you've had a busy afternoon, so thanks for coming in. I'm going to go ahead and hand you this mic, and I'll take this one over, but thanks, and welcome to our Ag Day panel.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. I'm the worst kind of panelist. I walk in when everybody thinks they're about ready to leave. I do apologize. We have a little thing called votes that took us away, and I don't know if you've heard, but being from Illinois, it's been a busy day today. I want to say thank you. I know I missed most of the introductions, and I'm not going to bore you with introductions. If you want to find out about me, Google me. Don't believe the bad stuff. But ag and ag issues obviously have been at the top of my portfolio since I got to Washington. It's been great to be able to serve on the House Ag Committee. I look forward to working with many of you, but I'd rather you get a chance to ask me a question since this is a panel, and I know I'm in the Senate and I'm trained to filibuster, but I will not do that to you today. So I'll open it up to any other questions so that we can all have a response.
Oh, we've got a question here in the back, and we'll take a microphone over to that individual so that she can ask. But while we're getting the mic over there, can you tell us a little bit, since you're chair of the subcommittee dealing with research, what's on the agenda here for your subcommittee?
Well, it's been interesting so far. Everything moves slower than what I would like here in Washington. But I got to give Chairman Conaway a lot of credit. We've been doing a lot of groundwork, making sure our committee members know the types of issues that we're going to tackle on our subcommittee, and also making sure that it fits in with what Chairman Conaway's agenda is for the full committee. I learned quickly during my first term that when your subcommittee chairman loses his voice and can't speak, you take over and become the chairman for a day. Maybe you might want to prepare for the backlash on the GMO labeling hearing that you're going to get. I had no idea that I was in favor of killing children. And I'm not asking anybody to start with mine. Don't get your ideas up. But it shows you the types of issues that we're going to face with this subcommittee regarding bio and horticulture and research. But there are issues that are important to this country. There are issues that are important to agriculture. There are issues that are important to our whole food supply chain. And these are the tough issues that we have to tackle, and we have to let science come to the forefront rather than hysteria. And those are issues that you face in agriculture every single day. And I think we need policymakers, Republicans and Democrats, that are willing to face the tough issues and stand in front of their constituents and also the agriculture community and make the decisions that need to be made.
There's a question back here. Please tell us who you are.
Hi, I'm Joanna Rosine-Mervis. I'm with AGREE. It's a collaborative multi-stakeholder initiative focused on transforming the food and agriculture system. I'm curious to hear from each of you if and how you think the federal research, economic, and education system needs to be transformed.
Would you like to start off with that?
Yes, all federal money should come to the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. That's reform.
Yeah.
As somebody who represents one of the land-grant universities, the University of Illinois, and three other public institutions and four private institutions with residence halls, there's not just research is not just going on at our land-grant universities who are leading the way. But even smaller liberal arts colleges are taking more of an approach when it comes to research, and especially when they're based in agricultural communities like Bloomington Normal, Illinois, where Illinois Wesleyan is leading the way in other research opportunities, my alma mater, Millikan University. So let's make sure when you look at the future of research that we look at innovative approaches, and when we do, as the federal government, begin to put forth competitive programs, let's make sure that we look at results and measure those results accordingly. Because what I've seen in the past, in a post-earmark era, competition reigns. And when competition reigns, let's make sure that results are what are measured when it comes to future opportunities.
Other thoughts on how we need to reform agricultural research?
Well, I already commented on how I think the extension delivery system needs to be changed. But we definitely, there's no question, we need more basic research at the land-grant universities.
And I said earlier when David brought up the PCAST report and the need for additional investment, and I've said that several times, that additional investment needs to not only be in USDA. And I know the questioner from Agree has actually, they've written quite a bit about that, about need for basic research funding, competitive research funding, at the level above traditional USDA programs. Now, as a land-grant university person sitting here, you know, I won't tell you all of my colleagues would agree with that, but I believe that needs to happen to elevate the ag and food agenda on the research scene.
Congressman, we're about ready to wrap up here, and I just want to finalize our discussion with one more question from you. What else would you like to hear from the agricultural community in terms of how you can do your job better in seeking more research funds or clearing the way for more agricultural research?
Well, number one, I ought to show up on time so I could hear from you directly. That always helps. Number two, just stay engaged. I mean, I look around this room and I see Jay over there. I see Colin up front staring everybody down. I see, you know, I see John and many of the folks that I'm working with. Michael spills water in my office. Agriculture's already engaged. The ag community is probably one of the most engaged sectors in public policy that we see here in Washington. But make sure that when you have priorities, that those priorities are expressed in a way that you don't run all over each other either. Because as a policymaker, it's pretty tough for us to become experts in all of our different areas of what we're supposed to be experts in. That's why we have the committees. That's why you have areas of expertise. But even then, sometimes we're only good at becoming experts in generalities. So when you do make sure you put your priorities forth, make sure you do it in a very concise way that's going to allow us to take what you discuss with us and then act on it. Because unbeknownst to the 24-hour news cycle, there are a lot of us out here that want to take advice and turn it into action. And understand that perfection is never going to be part of any piece of legislation. But we've got to take some wins, and instead of going for Hail Marys all the time, sometimes let's be thankful we run down the field at 5 yards at a time, get a lot of first downs, and end up getting into the end zone. So thank you very much. Again, I apologize for being late, but for those of you who know me, you're welcome.
Well, thank you, Congressman.
The gentleman that's been waiting very patient.
Oh. Sarah.
All right, last question.
Fair enough. Your panelists have given us some great cutting-edge technology presentations across the board, including a couple of producers. One subject that hasn't seemed to come up, though, is that once we have these good technologies, whether they be in soil health or soil sciences, was listed from Nebraska, or water conservation measures, the adaptation or adoption of those technologies across a larger number of farms in this country still seems to take 10 or 15 more years. Would there be any comments on how we might advance the adoption rate once we have established some good new procedures for whether it be water conservation or soil health or in order to get better yields? And it's the adoption rate lag that still seems to be there even in this 21st century.
Any other thoughts on that? Bill?
I guess I'm the dirt farmer here. If farmers make money doing something, they'll adapt immediately. I mean, the best example of that is Roundup Ready soybeans. You know, within 2 years, virtually all the soybeans in the country were Roundup Ready. It's got to be a financial incentive, especially today.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you. We were looking for our next special guest. We're going to take a little opportunity here. First of all, please join me in thanking all of our panelists for a great discussion on innovation. Good job. I really appreciate you taking your time to join us this afternoon. And we're going to have a special tribute next. And before I announce that, I'd like to have each of our panelists take a front row seat here so that you can see the video that we're going to play. Our focus today was on celebration of agriculture, but we also wanted to celebrate the career of a fantastic gentleman who I've had the opportunity to know over the years. And Ronnie has also known him very well because he's a native Nebraskan. And so, Ronnie, if you could please introduce the crowd our video tribute.
Well, first of all, Sarah, thank you very much for giving us the opportunity today as part of this event and National Ag Week to honor a really distinguished American and a really distinguished Nebraskan, native of Nebraska, Dr. Clayton Yeider. And I know many of you in the room have known Clayton throughout his career and the impact that he has had not only on agriculture but on things even beyond agriculture through his service in the government and in the private sector as well. Clayton had a vision and came to us a number of years ago saying that we need to have more students who come out of our university systems knowing how to operate in global trade and finance. And as you know, Clayton's history, and you'll see here in a moment, that was a key hallmark of his service when he was at USDA and when he was U.S. Trade Representative for our country. And we're very pleased that yesterday we announced the launching of fundraising for the Yeider Institute for International Trade and Finance at the University of Nebraska. Clayton has made the lead gift for that endowment, that we're raising three endowed chairs, one in business, one in law, and one in ag economics at the university to establish this new program. We've had the good help of video production, and you're going to hear from, in the next few minutes, a number of Clayton's friends and colleagues during his career that will tell you the story about why this is so important.
Stars. He just always believes that this day, when he woke up, he faced the best day of his life. And he has been at the very, very outer extremes of the power system in our country, and it hasn't affected him. He is just the decent, honorable guy that grew up on that farm in Nebraska.
I've always figured that God must have put in the world a bunch of people that are smarter than I am. In negotiations, success is a combination of smarts and how well prepared you are. So I figured if the other person is going to be smarter than I am, and you better assume that, then you better be prepared to outwork that other person in order to level the playing field at the negotiating table. So that's really been the thrust in my view on this my entire life. I learned a lot of that from my father, who was one of the hardest working people ever on the face of this earth, and my mother was not far behind him. So that was built into me at an early age, and overall I think working that hard has served me well.
Clayton really was the first person who started kicking the door down when it came to agricultural trade. So much of the work that I did was really following in his footsteps. Oftentimes I would sit down and someone would say to me on the other side of the table, Mr. Secretary, do you know Clayton Yeider?
I don't know of any other cabinet officer who's taken the time and the effort to help his successor move forward. I look back on those years as having Clayton as a true partner.
I'm currently involved in the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations, and a key part of making that agreement come together is market access in Japan. and Clayton's work 30 years ago to open the beef and citrus markets in Japan, the way that he engaged with them to transition those markets and provide greater access are the starting point for what we're doing today.
Clayton had a huge impact on the WTO. This was Clayton's vision. His belief was that not only would you open up the marketplace to trade, not only would we be able to sell our beef and our pork and other products worldwide, but it would be a system based upon rules.
The Uruguay Round commitments that countries have made in agriculture and the disciplines they've agreed to follow really are the starting point for all of our future negotiations, whether they be trying to get countries to live up to bilateral commitments or entering into new negotiations for a free trade agreement. That's sort of the bedrock we start from, and how those countries have agreed to treat other nations and to abide by a rules-based trading system. And so basically he created the framework that we're building off of as we move forward. And so really the Uruguay Round commitments and the WTO infrastructure is the foundation of our work. So his contribution is really felt every day.
What Clayton taught us is that we were good enough to compete with anyone. That if he, as the negotiator, could open the doors and through a rules-based system establish a level playing field, then he built the confidence in the Nebraska farmer or rancher that we could sell our beef or our corn or our soybeans, wheat, whatever it was, any place in the world as a high-class, high-quality product.
President George H.W. Bush writes of the Clayton Yeider Institute. The Clayton Yeider Institute for International Trade and Finance is a wonderful tribute to an individual who has truly had an impact on agriculture on a global scale. Clayton is tough as nails, knowledgeable, energetic, and a friend of agriculture. When I selected Clayton as the 23rd Secretary of Agriculture in 1989, I knew he would fight hard for farming and fair trade. He and his USDA team were responsible for much of the 1990 Farm Bill, moving U.S. farm policy toward greater market orientation. Coupled with the markets, which opened during his time as U.S. Trade Representative, his efforts led to an unprecedented expansion of agricultural exports. I have no doubt that future generations of students will greatly benefit from the creation of this new institute and will be able to continue Clayton's legacy of being a game changer in the area of trade and finance.
When I came in, we had the largest trade deficit in this country's history, and there was a great clamor to do something about it. I heard all that commentary as I was going through my Senate confirmation as U.S. Trade Representative. And I was convinced that we had to have a very aggressive trade policy. Jim Baker, who was Secretary of the Treasury and Chairman of the Economic Policy Council at that time, fully agreed. And he wanted to be aggressive in the financial arena as well, and he was. So between the two of us on trade policy and financial policy, we really had an aggressive administration with the leadership of President Reagan at that time.
James A. Baker, former Secretary of the Treasury and Secretary of State, writes, Clayton Yeider is a first-class example of the model American public servant, a man who always placed his country's best interests above any other consideration. Perhaps his biggest accomplishments occurred when he was U.S. Trade Representative under President Ronald Reagan. His role then was indispensable during the negotiations for the historic 1987 Canada-United States Free Trade Agreement, which sparked the liberalization of trade, not only between those two countries, but also around the world. Our nation is stronger because of Clayton Yeider's service to it.
And if we can create an Institute of International Trade and Finance at the University of Nebraska that will begin to impact the lives of hundreds, if not ultimately thousands of students, then we will have changed the world in the future.
I believe that international trade builds the bridge between the nations and creates peace in the world, and that's where I hope all this knowledge and my skills will come into play. So I definitely want to work in the international trade and agriculture between the United States and Eastern European countries or other countries.
They could take a page from Clayton's book. Not only did he study agriculture, but he got a law degree. And and he was in the private sector at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and he came into government. So he has had private sector, business experience, legal training, and government experience.
When the father of the World Trade Organization is a graduate of the University of Nebraska and formerly a very prominent person in our state, it seems to me that it's an extremely appropriate way to recognize him. But it's very, very important that we start getting a significant effort into teaching our students the value of global trade, the value of international relations, and how interlocking these relationships are.
Today we are a world society, and as we interact with different countries and different people, we need to know about their cultures, and so this center will bring all that together and better prepare our students for a career in international agriculture or international activities of one kind or another. It's a great legacy to a great Nebraskan who has been one of our most notable and visible and distinguished alumni.
So I think his legacy will be the careers and the accomplishments of all of those individuals who benefited from his time and his encouragement and his wisdom.
If we can just get everybody thinking a lot more about things international, which they must do, then we will have left a lasting legacy. Thanks very much to all of you. That's a wonderful ovation. This is the first time I've seen that, so it brings tears to my eyes, as you might expect. So, you know, Lisa and Sarah and everybody who worked on it, thank you. Ronnie Green for your leadership in this. Carla Hills, thanks so much for participating and being here today. A lot of friends from the Yeider era in this audience here. I know you really didn't, the rest of you didn't come to see me. You came for Sarah's program, which obviously was a really good one. So I'm sorry I've delayed your reception, which is why you're really here. But I want to thank all of you for being here, including those who didn't come for that particular purpose. You know, we have great expectations for this institute. We want to establish it and let it build on itself. Hopefully it'll be around a long time after I'm no longer here. I apologize for my voice, by the way. It's not nearly as strong as it normally is. The reason for that is I had a little rugged battle with chemotherapy last week that almost did me in, so I'm recovering from that, fortunately. But it takes a little while to get your strength back and your voice back. So my apologies for that. But again, just thank you all. And Sarah, let me give it to you because you want to take it from here. You're all very great.
Well, Clayton, what an honor to have you here, and it's just always so great to see you, and to have this tribute to you, I think, is a wonderful example of the things we should be celebrating, not only on National Ag Day, but throughout the year. So thank you for joining us. As you mentioned, we do have a reception plan to thank everyone who's an AgriPulse subscriber. If you're not yet on our list, we can fix that. But we would like you to join us for the next 2 hours for hospitality and for a chance to talk one-on-one with Clayton, if you can stay for a little bit, and for other dignitaries here, Ambassador Hills, and so many others who have joined us. So we ask you to do only one more thing, and that is that this room has to magically turn into now our reception area with bars in each corner that are open as soon as we move all the chairs. So if you could grab one and or help push one to the front of the room where Jason and Al are standing, or over here where I'm going to stand, we'll start our reception. So thank you again, everyone. We really appreciate it.